Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, writer and director Damien McCarthy on a scary new horror, Hokum, and what it was like growing up in a video shop. The Fat Lady Sings lead singer Nick Kelly has a fantastic new documentary out called The Song Cycle, all about cycling to Glastonbury. And The Devil Wears Prada is back in the imaginatively called The Devil Wears Prada 2. And we hear what it's all about and if it's any good. You can email the show screentime@newstalk.com. This show is on the radio, but of course you can listen as a podcast on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. Now, I'm going to start, you know, in slightly annoyed fashion, and I'm sorry to do this. You know, regular listeners know that I do not spend a long time telling you why something isn't very good. I'm not one of these people who spends 10 minutes saying this is so bad and here's the reasons why. If it's not good, move on. Let's spend time talking about good things. But last week, we did tear apart the new Michael Jackson biopic, me and Chris Wasser, Michael, because it is terrible. It's barely a movie. It's a bland TV movie version of a life. But what's worse than that is it really whitewashes Michael Jackson's life and times with absolutely no mention of the elephant in the room. And yet it has gone gangbusters at the box office. So I'm going to start with that little caveat, shows you what I know. But I just, you know, I'm delighted people go to the cinema, as you know. But this is really tripe. So one of us is wrong. All the millions of people going to watch it are me or Chris Wasser. But anyway, there you go. Michael, the biopic, Michael, as it's just called, is storming home and breaking box office records. Go figure. Now, we start most weeks with TV, what I've been watching, what I'm recommending to you. And I'm going to do the same, but it's not what you were expecting, because this week, the most entertaining piece of TV I saw all week long was this.
Which trademark logo is described in the James Joyce novel Ulysses and depicted in works by Manet and Picasso? Bass Ale, The Famous Grouse, Coca-Cola, or Stella Artois?
I'm going to go for Bass Ale. And that's my final answer.
You didn't even... I mean, you don't know that.
It's because of the painting.
You've won £1 million!
Yes, folks, that was retired IT analyst Roman Dabowski on last week's or Sunday night's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And he won £1 million. Hats off to him. A James Joyce connection there. I think I knew the answer to that one. That's of no consequence. What is of consequence is this was a great watch. I watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire occasionally. I nearly watched it by accident on Sunday night and I couldn't turn away from this. This guy Roman started pretty poorly. He missed or had to ask the audience for, I think it was £1,000 question about making egg mayonnaise, and I thought this guy's not at the races. Then made it all the way to £1 million with still two lifelines. You know, quiz shows, they're not everyone's bag. They're not really mine. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is a great piece of TV. It's such a clever format. And Jeremy Clarkson, you know, people have differing views on him. He's a very good host. And you know what? He was very behind this guy winning £1 million and he reveled in it. So normally, you know, I recommend to you TV you might have missed or some great new show on Netflix or Apple TV or Disney or Paramount that I really want you to watch. But this week, I had to be honest with you. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was the best piece of TV I saw. So watch it back on the Virgin Media Player if you can, because Roman Dabowski winning £1 million was a great piece of television. Let me know what you've been watching, either in the cinema or on the small screen. Or maybe you have a big screen at home, which is a TV, of course. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Yes, you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, a very big release of the year. Some people are saying it's the biggest of the year. I don't know. That catastrophe that was Michael was a pretty big one last week. I am talking about The Devil Wears Prada 2. I haven't seen it, but Niamh O'Reilly has, and she's also seen a great new Irish movie, the director of which we're going to be talking to after the break, called Hokum. But without further ado, complete with No Doubt t-shirt on this sunny day in Dublin, I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Niamh O'Reilly. Hello, Niamh.
How are you?
Does anyone else give you such a long and winding introduction?
I love your introductions, John. Excellent. They're great.
Why wouldn't you?
What's not to like?
So listen, The Devil Wears Prada 2. I mean, The Devil Wears Prada, irrespective of what you thought of it, I mean, I thought it was a pretty decent movie. It was a massive movie of this century. One of the biggest. Anne Wintour and possibly being sent up by Meryl Streep. It was a massive deal, wasn't it?
Massive deal. And I think a lot of people were kind of a bit kind of sceptical or, you know, a bit, you know, iffy about it, some of the more maybe harder critics. But I think when they sat down and actually watched it, they changed their minds and said, this is actually a pretty good film. And, it, you know, it has a lot to say about the industry itself.
Are we talking about one or two here?
One.
Yes,
one.
Okay,
yeah, going
good.
Back to one. Yeah. So I think over time it has aged well and people have realised actually that was a really good film as well, being a huge hit.
But it's pretty, or I mean, we think it's definitely Anne Wintour who was being sent.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is a book that inspired the first one. And I believe there was a second book written that might have loosely inspired this. But I think what's great about this film, like 20 years has passed in real life and in the film as well. And the filmmakers sort of said, we're not just going to sort of write a story to cash in. Now, there is commercial tie-ins here with Starbucks and stuff like that, but that's for another conversation. But what I mean is the story, I think, is very relevant, the story that they've picked.
So
the
what
sequel.
Is the story?
So, as I said, 20 years has passed. Miranda Priestley is still the editor of Runway magazine, which, as you alluded to, is a high fashion a glossy magazine in the stylings of Vogue. And she's still there 20 years
played
later.
Played wonderfully by Meryl Streep.
By Meryl Streep. Brilliantly played by Meryl Streep. And when the film opens, we see her in a little bit of crisis, which is unusual for her. The world obviously has changed. The world of publishing has changed. And it's all about kind of social media now and viral clips. And the magazine is going viral for the wrong reasons. They ran a story about a company that has links to a sweatshop.
Okay.
So Miranda is sort of on the precipice of being cancelled here.
Right. And is Miranda very anti-clickbaity kind of journalism?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, she and Stanley Tucci, who plays... he's back as Nigel, her right-hand man, and probably closest friend, even though she doesn't treat him particularly well. He's still there. They're very much about the artistry and the storytelling, you know, and the layouts and what a high fashion glossy magazine was 20 years ago, you know, and it just isn't as relevant today. Yeah. So that's all feeding into the story here. And so she's on the precipice of being cancelled. This is all going viral. The owners of the magazine are trying to fix this. And by a little quirk of fate, Anne Hathaway's character, Andy Sachs, who you'll remember from the first film, she's out there in the wild as a journalist. She's doing really well for herself. She's won lots of awards. And in a funny twist of fate, she unfortunately has lost her job. Her publication is downsizing, again, reflecting what's happening in the world of print media. So she's at a loose end and she's a well-respected writer. So the owners of the magazine draft her in to try and rehabilitate the magazine's kind of image and the narrative around it, and she comes in as the features editor, which is quite a senior role.
So the band are back together.
The band are back together, and then the fourth member of the band, who you may be wondering about, Emily, played by Emily Blunt.
Blunt, yeah.
So she no longer works at Runway, but she has segued very nicely into a very senior role in Dior, which are one of Runway's biggest advertisers. Mm-hmm. So at the start of the film, we see the trio go off to meet Emily and sort of appease her because, you know, they want the advertising in the magazine. So a nice little change of the dynamic there because Emily was Miranda's assistant.
Yes,
in the original.
And treated very badly at times.
Very poorly, yeah.
And, you know, the thing that, you know, Meryl Streep's character in the first one, she was horrible and flung things at people. Has she mellowed a bit?
It's funny, in some ways she hasn't. So I don't want to say she's a dinosaur, but she's of a very particular, like pre-Me Too era. But the film does address that and there's some funny scenes where she has to hang up her own coat, for example, instead of throwing it at the assistant because HR will complain. And she
What's
has
the
to,
word coming to you? You can't even hug your secretary anymore.
Totally. And like in meetings, you know, she says some very inappropriate things and her assistant is sort of going, no, you can't say that. And she's sort of like, what can't I say? You know, so there's some very humorous moments zoning in on her and how she has to change, really. And there's a wonderful sort of speech by Nigel halfway through the film where he talks about, like, in the past, they would have got, you know, massive budgets, you know, flown to some exotic country for a week, done, you know, gorgeous high fashion shoots. And now he's working on a shoestring to do content that people will scroll by while they're on the toilet.
Yeah.
So it's just totally different and everything's clickbaity. And how many, much engagement and clicks. So it's about really the publishing industry as it is today and the challenges it's facing. So it's a very relevant story.
Is there drama in it as well? I mean,
there is drama, and it's funny. Like the story, the beats in this story mirror almost exactly the beats of the first film in some ways. So it was a little bit repetitive, but I could see what they were doing with it. So the story kind of follows the same track. There is, you know, a crisis involving Miranda, and Andy has to help in some way. And there's a beautiful European location. Last time it was Paris. This time it's Milan. It's fashion. Week. So very similar beats going on, and the chemistry between those core four cast is fantastic. When all four of them are together in particular, it's magic. You
They're
know they haven't
actors,
lost it,
so,
like 20 years has gone by and they just slip back into those roles.
So are you saying this is good?
I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought. I have to preface it by saying I was a huge fan of the first one. Like, I was a lowly intern when I went to see this, and I just totally identified with the character of Andy. So I do have a really soft spot for it. But I think really the characters are fantastic. I mean, Stanley Tucci and Meryl Streep, even the two of them together, they're just amazing.
Worth the price of admission,
and
nearly.
The budget, I have to say, I don't know how much they spent on this, but it has to be double or triple what they did the first time around. Everything is luscious and beautiful and it is gorgeous to look at, and the cast is fantastic. I felt it went on a little bit too long. They could have shaved maybe a good 20 minutes off the end of this. I have to shout out Justin Theroux is in this as well as a sort of Musk-type crazy
tech
billionaire.
Bro, billionaire.
And it was very kind of strange little character. I found him really odd and I didn't like him, but I think he was doing it on purpose.
Right.
But I just, I was not a fan of when he was on screen. I just was like, eek.
Okay. Too many real world parallels.
Maybe
perhaps.
I'm triggered. Yeah.
And so look, people loved the first movie and you were one of those people. So I guess your reservations, and certainly mine, even though I haven't seen it, is this like other movies of recent weeks could be a shameless cash grab based on the popularity of the first one, but it's not that.
I mean, I think there's an element of that. You can't deny it. There's 20 years has gone by. There are a lot of commercial tie-ins here. There's Diet Coke and Starbucks all over the place.
Okay.
But I do think the story is relevant and it's not just a cash grab.
Okay.
And I think it works well. It's not as magical as the original.
Yeah.
But there's some lovely little, I know people don't like fan service, but I like fan service.
Yeah.
You know, when it's done well, there's some lovely little Easter eggs here.
To the first movie.
Yes, that you're going to just go, yes. So that'll annoy some people.
Okay, so a partial cash grab, but still a decent watch and making points about how decrepit modern journalism has come, in essence.
Yeah.
So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Devil Wears Prada 2, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 1st of May?
I'm going to say 3 stars.
3 stars. Okay, fantastic. We better take a clip. Well, not fantastic, but not bad, I think.
Yeah, as Miranda would say, that's all.
I got slightly distracted there because you said the first thing I realized, it's my wife's birthday on the 1st of May. So belated happy birthday, darling.
Oh,
let's take a clip of The Devil Wears Prada 2.
He said that we need to, Runway needs to take control of the narrative of the Speed Pass story and restore credibility. And he thought someone with my expertise would be a good idea. But I thought that for sure you had approved and were excited. And that's why I came in here all like, oh.
Amari?
Yes.
Get Ashley on the phone, please.
Hi, good morning, Miranda.
Yes, Ashley, flag on the play. We don't need you this morning or ever. So pack up your things and HR will be in to see you shortly. Happy? You just cost Cornell summa cum laude her job. First in her family to go to college, I believe. Anyway, come along.
come on.
That's a clip of The Devil Wears Prada 2, which Niamh O'Reilly gave 3 stars to. Not a shameless cash grab. There's a bit of a story there, a bit of a shameless cash grab, but 3 stars nonetheless. So I don't think fans will be disappointed.
No, you will. If you like the first one, you will really enjoy this.
The diverting 2 hours or whatever.
It's a little bit long, but it does flag a little in the middle. But like when they get to those montages, when they're in Milan and all the clothes and Vogue is going in the back, I mean, it's a joy.
Okay. Yeah. So listen, something very different. We're going to quickly talk about it because I'm interviewing the director after the break, but I want to get your take on it because you're a horror fan. This is Hokum by one of our, well, it's only his third feature, but he gave us a great feature called Oddity 2 years ago. Yeah. What's going on in Hokum?
This, can I just say, this is fantastic. And I was lucky enough to get to a screening where Damien was introducing it.
Yeah.
And you'll be talking to him, and he's a fantastic guy.
He is.
This is his third film. And it's fair to say that this is a step up from the last two films, which were kind of small budget. Mm. And Hokum stars Adam Scott,
yes,
who people will know from Severance, probably.
Big Little Lies.
Yes, and Parks and Recreation.
Yes.
Yeah. So he normally plays comedic kind of roles, but this is very serious.
Yeah.
And he's playing, I would say, kind of a gruff, sort of unpleasant
very
kind
unpleasant,
of guy.
Yeah.
He's a writer, a successful writer. He's trying to finish his trilogy of books, which are also quite bleak, and the ending of which seems to be quite bleak.
Mm.
And he is a man, I would say, who was haunted by his past, by a trauma in his past. And he comes across the ashes of his dead parents and decides to go to Ireland, where they honeymooned, to spread the ashes and, I don't know, maybe make a little peace with himself while he's there. He stays in a very sort of rundown, remote hotel in Galway, and things take a decidedly spooky turn when he finds the honeymoon suite where his parents would have stayed is locked.
Mm.
And the story that he's told by the quirky staff there is that the owner caught a witch in that room and locked it up, and no one is allowed in there since.
Mm. The honeymoon suite motif is kind of very eerie. What I really liked about this, but you tell me, is that there are some genuine scares in this, right?
Yeah, I saw this in a packed house, which is great for horror. It's so good. And the people beside me jumped at certain points. Their popcorn went up in the air. I'd say a few people might have even wet their pants. So there is genuine jump scares in this, which is great, and I love that because it's rare, you know, because
really
we're always
is.
Looking for where the jump scare is, but he manages to catch the audience out here. But can I also say there's a lot of comedy and humour in this, and dark comedy, which kind of works.
There's people
very
shooting
well.
Goats with crossbows, and Peter Coonan's in there.
That's right.
And David Wilmot.
Yeah, who plays like this quirky guy who lives in the forest and does a lot
who
of
drinks
mushrooms.
Mushroom juice.
He mixes it with goat milk,
that's right,
which is even weirder. So a great collection of oddball characters. But Adam Scott is the heart of this. He's really good in it. And because he's so unlikable, I think it just works even better. He's not someone you're exactly rooting for.
No.
But it's dark and it's eerie and there's tension. I absolutely loved it. I think he is a fantastic director.
Yeah.
And, you know, this has got big studio backing, so he's only going from strength to
absolutely.
Strength.
So it's fantastic. If you want to hear more, Damien will be on the show after the break. Niamh is talking about Hokum, a great new Irish horror. I mean, it's a comedy, but it's first and foremost a horror.
Yeah.
And a very scary one at that. Niamh, what would you give it stars-wise?
Hearty 4.
4 stars for Hokum. We shall take that as it's intended. So that's 4 stars for Hokum, a great new Irish thriller, horror, comedy, but really a horror, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 1st of May. And also The Devil Wears Prada 2, which Niamh O'Reilly gave 3 stars to. I'm getting my digits. I need an abacus. 3 stars. Niamh, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Niamh O'Reilly there on the week's new releases. And as we were pointing out, we're going to be talking to the director of Hokum after the break, which is a really scary movie. Stay tuned. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, as I was telling you before the break, there is a great new movie out called Hokum, a horror movie where Adam Scott plays a man called Owen Bowman, who's a pretty awful novelist. Well, he's a great novelist, but he's not a very nice man. And he goes to this isolated Irish hotel to scatter his parents' ashes. The hotel has some of its own stories, folklore. Chief among that folklore is a honeymoon suite that is closed by the eccentric owner for a long time because it's said to possibly contain a ghost. As the action moves on, Bowman becomes kind of obsessed by this honeymoon suite, particularly when a female employee goes missing. This, as I mentioned before the break, is a brilliant, eerie, sometimes funny horror movie. It was written and directed by Damien McCarthy. It's only his third feature, but he's really making a name for himself. He had a movie out in 2024 called Oddity that was, again, a brilliant horror movie. This is next level stuff. It's getting great reviews. I spoke to Damien earlier in the week, who has a very interesting career. He grew up in a video shop. He worked as an electrician, but he's now very much a movie maker. Let me start with a curveball, Damien. So I was thinking of The Exorcist, and I'll tell you why. Because The Exorcist starts in a desert with something that seems very unconnected. And without giving a spoiler, the first scene of your movie is in a desert. Is there any parallels? Discuss.
You're the first person I had never thought of that, but now very clearly I can see that there's some inspiration.
But it wasn't in your mind.
Yet. Never in my mind, no, but it's a really good comparison. Yeah, because the whole idea was that opening would feel disconnected to everything that's coming. It was even with the script. I mean, when I gave out that script, people would start reading and they'd be a couple of pages in and they're going, why are we in the desert with a conquistador? I thought this was set in Ireland in a haunted hotel. So, that's a very good comparison.
Okay, you'll take it.
I will.
Tell me this. Adam Scott is great in this, but he's deeply unpleasant. He's not a nice guy. And we're used to the protagonists of horror movies, like we're on their side, kind of, you know, even sorry to stop mentioning other movies, but even The Shining, Jack Nicholson, we're kind of sympathetic to him at start. We don't like your protagonist. Is it an effort? Is it a trick of the writing to get us on side? Like, were you conscious of that? This guy isn't nice. How am I going to win people over to root for him? Which we do.
That was the challenge. Usually in horror movies, a character starts off very, pleasant and you're on their side. You know, you hope nothing happens to them. And then by the time they get to the end of the horror movie, they're covered in blood and they've been through everything and they're all, you know, now they're tough and they're much harder. I kind of wanted to do the opposite. I wanted to start with a character who is very hard to begin with and very kind of, you know, mean to people he meets and even people that like him and are fans of the character, he's standoffish with them and borderline cruel. But then by the end of the movie, it's kind of the opposite of a normal horror film. By the end of it, after everything he's been through, he's much softer. He's kind of been able to let go of a lot of stuff that's been going on inside of him.
Yeah.
So that was very much it. It was like, how do you make the audience go in that first act? Oh, I really hope this guy gets punished because we hate him. And then as the film goes on, you go, actually, I kind of wouldn't mind seeing this guy get out of the situation because, you know, there's more to him than what we first saw.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's a spoiler. The honeymoon suite is the motif or one of the chief motifs in this. I don't know, is there some elaborate metaphor for marriages going south or anything like that? Or is it just a useful trope?
just a useful trope. The haunted presidential suite mightn't have been as scary. I think just, you know, it allowed me to kind of have lots of production design with hearts and the big bathtub. There was just something about it, you know, a four-poster bed with the canopy around it. There was just a way to kind of... I just found that more interesting.
Adam, just to go back to him, he's terrific in it because he's so unpleasant at the start and then what he puts himself through. I'm sure, you know, people don't write movies thinking this will be great for Adam Scott, but was it a happy dovetailing of events? He liked Oddity, is my understanding of how you got him, or?
That's it, yeah. I think with every film that there's always some lucky break in there somewhere where, you know, a location, a producer, an actor, something happens that you go, okay, great. Now the film is it's going to be the way I wanted it. And definitely with Adam, it was one of those things where he'd seen Oddity and he read Holcomb. And at the same time, I was thinking of him saying, you know, I've seen him play characters that aren't very pleasant. And then he plays... Yeah. The character in Severance is so complicated. And obviously he's got such a history then with comedy. He has a kind of natural charisma. So all of that stuff, that's all the stuff that I would like, that the first American actor that I'll have worked with, that's kind of what I'd like all that to be. And I'm such a fan of Adam's that it just worked. It was just, it was the lucky thing that happened on this film for sure.
You kept it very local, West Cork, and you've been doing that. And I know Oddity did very well for you. So was there any pull to take it somewhere else, or was everyone with your vision that this needed to be in where it was?
It's probably the first thing out of my mouth with anybody, you know. It's like, I'm shooting this in, so, you know, glad you like the script. I'll be shooting this in Cork.
You can have any color you want once it's black.
Yeah, it's like, you know, because I have my crew, and that there's, you know, that the crew are from all over, yeah, Ireland, and they're such a hard-working crew, and they're you know, some of the best people, you know, both to spend time with and at their job. So it's like, yeah, I have that shorthand developing with them now. It's just like, I really want to go back down to West Cork, because we have the studio there now, and I want to make use of all these locations that nobody is filming in, because,
yeah,
know, just not down there filming enough. So yeah, that was very much the first thing, going like, we'll be shooting this in Cork if you're interested. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. So I hope to keep doing it.
And, you know, I don't want to ask you a leading question, but it seems to me 10 years ago, you mightn't have been able to follow through on that. You're a director who's coming up and you have success, that they might have, you know, the people paying for it and financing it might have pushed to have it somewhere else. But because of all that's going on in our booming film industry, it's an easier sell. But you tell me, maybe I have that wrong.
It's probably, again, I think even without, I mean, caveat, we just made in our own. We'd, yeah, no budget for that. We shot, yeah, that in Bantry, where I'm from, up at Bantry House. That was just with family and friends that I made that. But then that led to Oddity. And Oddity wasn't a big budget movie by any means, but it was a huge budget for me at the time.
Yeah.
But again, I think what helped there was I had found the location. It was like, I know the room, and the room was so important to that movie, having the visual look and the horror and everything I needed. And when I was able to go, here's the location, I have it, I have the photographs, I have it storyboarded for here. It was just hard to argue with that then, even though there was initially, you know, that there's a great location, you know, elsewhere in the country, or maybe even abroad. It was like, it really needs to be here. So I think now with the three films, I think if anybody sees me coming with a script that they like, they'll be saying, okay, we'll be off to Ireland with this.
Excellent. That's a good place to be in. Yeah. A hotel, and I think it was a house or an elaborate house that you shot it in. It's very, it was hard to place it in time. And even the car regs, I was trying to get clues. Is this now? Is this 25 years ago? Was that deliberate?
Yeah, I keep doing it. It's like, and I say it to all of the art department, to costume, to everybody, go like, just, you know, don't be too worried about something being contemporary. Like, this can be really any time. We just know that it's at some stage in the last 20 years. I think the reason for that is just to help the film age.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think one of my favorite films is The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing, and it's like, that was shot in whatever, 1981, 82. And you can watch it today and go like, yeah, this looks, there's nothing in it that really dated. And again, that's probably because of the location. They're in like a research station, and they're all in overalls and you know, warm clothing, but there's something about that I always liked, trying to keep it as timeless and as vague as possible.
Yeah, you know, it's really scary at times, which is great, and like, real, you know, jump scares can be a dirty word, but there's one or two in this that, oh man. And I'm a 50-year-old bloke who doesn't scare easy, but do you sit down and go, I gotta put some really scary bits in here, or does it just become part of the story as it emerges?
It would be in the script as I'm going along, you know. You kind of not that you'd go, okay, it's been 10 pages, or which means it's been 10 minutes or so, I need to put in another scare. I'm happy to go long stretches without anything scary happening. I just think it's all about that, more about the tension, that there's an atmosphere to the film, and that you feel a little bit on edge, and you feel like, you know, that you get that sense that, like, something's going to happen. Like, I've, you know, you start to, that's kind of been what I've been trying to do, and what I'm going to keep trying to do with my horror films, is kind of have that slow feeling of dread as you're getting eased into the film, and then before it's too late, then you know, you kind of start hitting people with these scares and you know, more unsettling imagery.
Well, mission accomplished. The fact that your dad, he ran an electrical business, but he had a video store in the 80s and 90s in Cork. Like, is that just manna from heaven for a future filmmaker?
I would blame that shop for sure. that was another big thing. I mean, my dad was a huge, he still is a huge horror and sci-fi fan. So, like, you know, you come in after school, put down your school bag, you're kind of waiting for your mom to finish work, whatever. So you'd be just hanging around and reading. In the 80s and 90s, just a very different time for VHS shops. You can remember the old artwork on the cover and you'd read it back. And that would just spend my evenings doing, just in there and taking all the posters home. So yeah, it definitely had a huge huge impact on me. I just loved films from a very young age, and because I had my parents had the video shop, I had that, maybe that bonus that nobody else had, where I could take films home and keep them at home for a week or something and
watch them. Without late fees.
Without late fees, yeah. I'd get in trouble, right, for sure, because people come into the film into the shop and go like, we don't know where these films are, they're all, you know. It was informative.
Use your dad. Do you remember in Extravision? You used to get charged, certainly in the one I grew up beside in Blanchardstown, if you didn't rewind the tape. They used to charge you 50p. Yeah, I presume your dad wasn't as mercenary as that, was he?
I don't remember that one. No, we didn't have that. Yeah.
You worked with your dad for a while in his business, I understand. Yeah. Was there a moment in your career where you actually said, okay, now I'm a filmmaker? Like when you stopped that job and you weren't actually terrified that if you did this, you have to go back to something else. Like, was there, or I presume you're there now, but when was the moment you thought, okay, this is actually my job?
It was late, and I talked to a lot of, we'll say, people who are making short films who want to move to features or film studios, or whatever. And I tell them all, it'll probably take, and it's an answer you don't really want to hear, but it's like, if you can stick with it for, and again, it could happen for somebody else overnight, but I think if you can stick with it for a good 10 years and take all the rejection and kind of keep something of a positive attitude with it and kind of believe it will happen eventually and somebody will say yes, or else just, you know, go do it yourself. I mean, I left school when I was 15, so I think it was probably once I got to Oddity was really the first time I was able to make any kind of paying the rent with it. Like, so it's still... You know, I'm 45 now, so you know, I guess I got like 10 years out of it anyway so far. So yeah, but it takes a while, you know. I probably went at it maybe some of the wrong ways, focusing too much on scripts that weren't working, or you know, spending too much time on short films or something. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's ways to make it happen quicker, and I try to, anybody that reaches out to me or just film students, whatever, I try to, you know, tell them where all the potholes that I drove into are, and they can try to avoid them.
I hear musicians say that a lot, exactly what you said just there. Really? Do you think it was, I don't know, you know, you might have felt like you weren't progressing and failing at times and into the potholes, but maybe that you didn't have a choice, but like, this is what you wanted to do, so you were going to do it, even if the universe at times was saying you're not doing it.
That's it. I mean, I look back now and I can't believe how... kind of think you're delusional, you know. It's like, I can't, it's funny, you go like, God, I was really, really determined to get a job making films, you know. And even Caveat was such a difficult film to make. It took 2 or 3 years with no budget. I was editing that film and sound designing it at weekends and after work, and but there was something, it's just that love of films. I really love horror movies and just films in general. And I do think films are one of those things where you can bring every art form together, like, you know, music and performance and all of the artists painting sets and building props and everything behind the sets. It's the one thing we get all of these super creative people together from everything, from the score, the whole thing together. So just something that was like, this is the thing I want to do for a living. So I think that kind of passion is maybe what got me through it.
Sure. Well, listen, God bless your delusion. It's Holcomb's a terrific watch, and it's going to scare people. So hopefully I'll meet you in person for the next one. All right. Lovely to see you again, Damien. Cheers.
You too. Cheers, Sam.
Take care.
Fado. Long, long ago, deep in the woods, there lived...
Is your kids?
No.
Don't talk to strangers.
There are worse things than strangers out there, Yank.
It's just a bit of crack.
Can I get a room as far away from the crack as possible?
First time in Ireland.
Yeah. My folks came here for their honeymoon. Always wanted to come back.
Why didn't they?
A clip there from Holcomb, which is now in cinemas, a great, scary movie. And you heard me talking to its director, Damien McCarthy. After the break, something very different, a great new documentary about the lead singer of the Fat Lady Sings, Cycling to Glastonbury. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, outside of Devil's Wearing Prada and Hokum Horrors, there is a delightful new documentary called The Song Cycle. Veteran, oh, he won't like that, musician and filmmaker Nick Kelly sets off to cycle from his home in Dublin to, wait to hear this, Glastonbury, playing in pubs and clubs along the way. With him is his easygoing musical partner, Sean Miller, who travels by bus for various reasons we'll get into, joining Nick on stage each evening as they head towards a triumphant performance in Glastonbury on what turns out to be Nick's 60th birthday. The documentary also features a type of kind of autobiography, and we see Nick look back on his life, which of course includes fronting the great Irish band, The Fat Lady Sings. The Song Cycle is in good cinemas from this Friday, the 1st of May, and I'm delighted to say he cycled in to News Talk. Nick Kelly, hello, sir.
How are you? Just catching my breath.
Yes, indeed. Well, you do that after my long intro. That's why I did such a long intro. He needs longer time to catch his breath. I'll do my poetry. No, listen, it's delightful, by the way. Documentary, you kind of say, look, I don't have high ambitions for this project, as in I'm not expecting you to, we're suddenly going to cycle to every gig. But there is a point in these gestures that it gets a conversation going. Now, you did this a couple of years ago. Do you still feel that way, that this was a good thing to do, no matter what efficacy it has?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. Well, I mean, I have a couple of things about it. I mean, one is that there's two bits to anything you do. So clearly, as I think a climate expert kindly paraphrases, but me cycling versus me driving to Glastonbury for my tiny gig with Sean, there's literally no carbon impact of that at all. Yeah. But I do think that the iconography of those things can be quite important. So, you know, like me doing something might get other people who have bigger organisations and better ideas to try something else. But it also sort of radiates out. And I think, I always think people underestimate how much, you know, and I even find as a musician, somebody will say, you know, I started a band because I heard your song. Like, and you know, who knows whether it's Nirvana who started the band or a completely obscure band who started a band because of your song. You never know. But I also have a thing about climate stuff generally, which is that almost everything to do with climate change is terrifying and shaming and disempowering. It's like the world is dying, it's your fault, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
And just as from a psychological point of view,
we're given out to nearly, aren't we?
Well, I mean,
I'm not a climate denier.
No. But I mean, there's obviously a huge problem. But I think the trouble with those strategies is it's a bit like terrifying somebody into good behavior. Yeah. It's like it doesn't produce action; it produces freezing or denial. And whereas I kind of think doing quite silly things sometimes, or quite sort of small personal, like not very organized things, maybe that cuts through more, because at least people get a bit, at least they don't immediately shut off, think, okay, somebody's shouting at me, I'm not going to listen to that.
Yeah.
So I kind of think there's something to it. We'll see.
And then, like, you brought a camera crew with you, or certainly a cameraman. Did that come after, or was it always this grand idea?
It wasn't a film at all. It was a music project. I was trying desperately hard to get a new feature drama made. I'd made The Drummer and the Keeper, which had done like really well, actually.
And a terrific film.
Thank you. And I had a couple of projects, and one in particular, which I was killing myself to try and get made. And I don't have to say this to you, it's a miracle that any film gets made.
Yeah, especially now.
And you know, it's just
I say that phrase every other week, yeah.
Yeah, and the frustration. And I just had this idea, as much to just be doing something. And it was just coming out of COVID as well. Yeah. So I just thought, as a music thing, as a music project, I was going to do this little thing, just take my mind off my completely frustrated film career. And at the last minute, I decided to bring a cameraman, a lithe Keane, who's a young man, very fit, on my spare bicycle. And we just had literally tiny, like our camera kit would fit into a laundry bag. Like he had a very small drone, and we used little DJI cameras and my camera phone, like my iPhone. And I just wanted him to document the journey. And then the first inkling that it might be a film was at the end, I brought the footage home and I showed it to my wife, and she said, well, on no account are you to ever show that to anybody outside of this house. Which perversely, of course, made me think, actually the smallness and the sort of humiliating things that you go through in the journey, that might in fact be make a film.
Yeah.
And then what we did was we went back. We did the journey again in 2023.
Okay.
I slightly changed the route to not have to cycle up that bloody hill into Bristol. But we did. We shot some B-roll and I went and I talked to lots of climate change experts and also then started getting into the archive thing. And I'd never made a documentary before. And you know, as a filmmaker, what I've always found is you start off with a plan, but no plan survives contact with the enemy. And whatever film you have in your head, what happens afterwards is not going to be that. Mm. If you've chosen the right people and cast well on both sides of the cameras and empowered those people, it'll be better than what you had in your head. If you shackle them, it'll be worse, but it's never what you think.
Yeah.
With a doc, the whole thing evolves as you're kind of going along. And I hadn't fully understood that. And one of the things about a doc is when you stumble across archive footage, light bulbs start going off and connect, you start, and incredibly, because nobody in the 1990s was carrying a 4K camera around in their pocket. But two people had filmed The Fat Lady Sings on the fateful American tour at the end of the band's history.
We'll get into that footage in a minute, but I just want to talk about the journey a bit. You know, Tommy Tiernan walked across Ireland doing gigs once and he said, you know, like you were saying, the romance of this in my head was a lot different to me on hard shoulders, dodging articulated trucks. There's a bit of that in this. I mean, there's tiny, narrow roads around the English countryside, and it's not romantic at all. At times, sometimes it looks lovely and you're in a zen state as you cycle, but other times it's downright dangerous and unpleasant.
I'm very used to cycling in cities. So the first thing to understand is, like, I am not the dude that you're going to meet up in the Dublin Mountains on a Saturday morning.
Okay.
I am the guy who cycles to the shops. But I find I'm confident in traffic because I cycle always in traffic. Having said that, it is true that if you're doing the long distances, I actually joined all these cycling groups, like Facebook pages across Wales and south of England, saying, can you give me a good route? We've got a brilliant route for you. Like, there's some fantastic hills. I said, no. You misunderstand. I need I'm trying to go somewhere, not in a circle, and as much not on hills as I can. So the infrastructure, there's quite a lot of cycling infrastructure, but a lot of it doesn't exactly join up. So you do find yourself on the hard shoulder a lot. And I was okay because the only person I'm going to kill is probably myself. But it is a bit scary, I think.
Yeah. But it makes for a good watch. The other thing about the journey, before you get to Glastonbury, and people have to watch the movie to see how Glastonbury goes, but particularly the first town you're in, it's unpronounceable. It was C-O-R-W-N. How do I say that?
Oh, it's the pub is called Cwrw, which is the Welsh for beer.
Yeah, okay, nice. But you and Sean, you're happy to be there, but, and I don't want to say Spinal Tap, right? But there seemed to be about six people in the audience. And I don't know, was it for the cameras? But you smiled all the way through and seemed to have a great gig. Now, Sean does make the point whether you're playing to 6,000 or 4,000 people, it doesn't matter. But that clearly seemed to be the case. You were happy to be there.
Yeah, I mean, what we had done, but first of all, we are incredibly obscure musical artists. So just get it out there. Spinal Tap is a kind of a documentary, as anybody who's ever been in a band will tell you. Everything sooner or later that's in that film actually happens to you in real life. But yeah, I mean, what we also did is, because we had 5 days to get to Glastonbury, I literally put in I found anything that had an open mic night or a kind of like a little gig. So we strung them together. But I'm not saying that if we'd had 3 months preparation, we'd have been playing stadiums. We definitely wouldn't have been.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but it was a needs must. Let's find a venue on route to here. Yeah.
But I mean, it was, so, you know, it was the promise of the premise. I'm a very lazy man, but I'm a very dutiful man. So I always tell people exactly what I'm going to do in advance, because then I'm too embarrassed not to do it. So I'd said, I'm going to do this and we're going to play gigs. So then, within the meaning of the act, Cwrw in Carmarthen, where we played, I think at the height of the show, there was 27 people in the room. But some of them are very cute, just people who had wandered in. It was Father's Day, so they were getting a pint with their missus and we were playing on stage. What happens is that, I mean, your embarrassment threshold, the great thing about being a musician is everybody who isn't a musician, and I think this is true of acting as well, they look at you and they think, I could never do that.
Yeah.
I'd be so mortified. The thing is, usually you've gone through all of that. You've no mortification left in you. The people who are mortified are the audience.
Yeah.
If you seem like you don't you're upset or you're not in control. So once, I think just smile and play the tunes and no, I don't mind it. You know?
We mentioned this archive footage. There's lots about the Fat Lady Sings and the American tour and the writing of Arclight, which you seem to, you just wrote in 30 minutes. But the stuff in the archive that I really like as well as that, because I knew some of that and I know Tom Dunn, who features in it far too much, by the way. I mean, I don't think you need him that much.
Tell him.
But your relationship with your dad is very interesting. People will know that your dad was a politician, a highly rated academic. There's some stat in that in his Leaving Cert, he got the second highest mark in Irish in it. And he was a public-facing figure. You know, it's not a classic, you didn't get on with your dad, but you had a lot to live up to, and he was had misgivings about the music, but then maybe came full circle with it. At this remove, how would you, you know, in 2 minutes... How would you label that relationship with your dad for people watching the doc?
I mean, I think, actually a very interesting thing. I saw recently Everybody Digs Bill Evans.
Mm.
And there's a scene in that which is an incredible scene. Now, I don't think it's quite like myself, my father, but where Bill Pullman and Anders Lie, the Norwegian actor, they're having a conversation. And it's an incredibly banal conversation.
Yeah.
But you can see in the scene all of the things that they wished that they could see. And I just think that, you know, in one way, I'm quite Buddhist about it. I think we didn't spend enough time in each other's company.
Yeah.
Because he was a politician for a very long time. And then I lived in London for a very long time. And I think, you know, he was just getting around to, like, and, you know, I'm now, you know, 4 years older than he was when he died.
Wow.
And he looks like such a grown-up to me in the pictures. And I feel like such a 17-year-old all the time. But, you know, I have kids myself. And one of the big things, I think, is there's a sort of a natural, like, you want to grow up away from your parents.
Yeah.
That is a natural thing to do, to define yourself differently. And then they have to work out how to deal with that. And we're all growing all the time. And when you're 59, you're growing as well. And I think he was just growing into us having an adult relationship, and I was probably growing into it as well, and then he's gone. So that's how I do characterize it. I think it was loving, but kind of not fully connected. And I guess we probably both thought, oh, we'll get around to it.
Yeah.
And then you don't get around to it. And I think it's, I will say that our generation of parents, and you know, Tom, I've talked about this as well, and Sean a lot, we have traded respect for intimacy.
Mm.
That, like, my kids tell me to F off all the time, which I would, the idea that I would have said that to my father, or you are stealing my clothes and stealing my t-shirts. But I know them much better.
Yeah.
And they know me much better.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good trade for all of the terrible things our generation is probably screwing up.
Yeah.
I will say that's one thing we should, in a general sense, pat ourselves in the back with. I think it was very hard for fathers in particular, I think that.
Fascinating. It's an interesting way of putting it. Tell me this. I was thinking watching this, though. So I'm sorry to say, even though I pride myself on knowing a bit about the music scene, I knew very few Dog songs. I thought I knew a lot of Fat Lady Sing songs, but I kept going, like, you're a musician. You also have to make a living. Are you hopeful that if enough people go see this, you might get some people listening into the back catalogue, because there's some great songs in there?
Thank you. I mean, I've no hope left at all. I think in the sense that, you know, I do get, it's so funny, I get my Imro statements. And I mean, Arclight, which is only the sixth biggest single the Fat Lady Sings have, it wasn't ever a hit, but it grew on people.
It was the sixth biggest single.
There's five songs that did commercially better
than
Arclight.
Okay.
But it's the one that it grew on people.
Yeah.
And most of my Imro statement is Arclight. So I do get modest income from it. I think I made this really, really, I could not have, there's a brilliant Conor Nyland's book. He said, I do not think is a contradiction to say that I didn't achieve my full potential, but I could not possibly have tried any harder.
Yeah.
And I feel that's true about my music career. I literally nearly killed myself trying to be successful.
Yeah.
And I pulled out in the nick of time. And in a way, that's what I really like making music as art.
Mm.
I'm really touched when people respond to it as art. I think music and film are literally the same thing.
Mm.
People say, which do you prefer? I literally think they're the same thing. Mm. I think the reason, I didn't make films until I was in my 40s, but the reason I think I'm able to make films is because all of the same things that I learned the hard way trying to make music, you know, about rhythm, about pace, about the chaos of other humans, about collaboration. I learned very hard way through not being good at it. And suddenly you come into film and it's exactly the same. Structure. Yeah. You know that kind of way? Structure. Like, if you don't have a course after 50 seconds, it's not a pop song. And you know all the novelists who start to try and write screenplays and they can't understand about inciting incidents. Like, I love that stuff.
I could talk to you all day, Mr. Nick Kelly, but we have miles to go before we sleep. His first documentary is a delightful watch called The Song Cycle. It is in cinemas. Go and see it this long bank holiday weekend or at any future stage. Hopefully it stays in the cinema a long time for you, Nick. It's delightful. And thank you for cycling into studio.
Thank you so much. Well, I'll be cycling around the country as well, Daisy. We're doing a row of screens.
Sorry, yes. Amendment, a PS to this interview. You're going to be going to Q&As for the movie on your bike.
Yeah, well, I just thought it's very hard to get audiences into any films. And I really thought, let's tour this like a gig. So we're in the cinemas for a week from Friday, the 1st of May in the IFI, and we'll do a week there. But then on Saturday, I'm going up to Drumahair. On Sunday, I'm going to Sligo. And on Monday, I'm going to Ballymote, or Wednesday, sorry, Ballymote. And then throughout May and June, we're doing one-off screenings across the country. So each screening will be an event. I'll cycle there. I'll bring my guitar. We'll do a Q&A. I'll sing
That's
a song.
That's event cinema I keep hearing about.
Well, it's kind of, it feels like it's honouring the theme of the film.
Yeah.
This film was made in a really independent way. And I'm very interested in seeing how can we promote it. Can we promote it in an independent way? And we need to think about those things. So I will be up and down the house. So don't knock me off my bike.
And is there a website if people want to find out?
Yeah, so nickkelly.ie. Slash the song cycle. They'll have all of the dates. We've 25 at the moment, 24, and there's a couple more coming in. I'm still to be confirmed. So
brilliant.
NickKelly.ie. Everything you could possibly want to know about the song cycle.
Well, I know the taste of the people who listen to this show more or less, and I tell you, you will, folks, definitely enjoy the song cycle. I can't say thank you again, Nick, but thank you again, Nick.
Thank you.
Nick Kelly there, talking about his new documentary, The Song Cycle. And if you want to find out more details, nickkelly.ie. And great to have Nick in studio. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the great Sally Field about the new Netflix movie, Remarkably Bright Creatures. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can email us, screentime@newstalk.com. You can listen back to this show or any previous shows on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your long bank holiday weekend. Leave you with a little music from the movies. And I can only finish with one thing, given what we've just been talking about. But no one's going to complain about that. So I will leave you with the gorgeous Arclight. And hope you all have a safe week ahead.
Shine like an arc light. Sing like a bird might sing when he was higher than heaven, higher than every other thing, some kind of arc light. Sparks in the street, I know that you've no answers.